Good morning.
Good morning.
Some of you look a little tired.
Nah.
How many of you still have either a sheet or a Bible with you?
Good morning. Are there sheets?
Well, I think we're down to the end of the sheets, except there might be a couple up there by that gentleman. She is right. Here's a Bible.
A Bible.
Well, I see a Bible over there by the piano.
There's a stand of Bibles right outside the door.
I just need about 9 or 3 to have it.
Nine?
Roughly.
You're going to be trying to manage to receive a warning.
Good morning, Daniel.
That's good.
Thank you.
We're going to read this together one more time. And after I read the introduction, those first two verses, let's just, whoever feels moved, please read the next verse, okay? One verse at a time. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying,
"Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted.
Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth.
Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled.
Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy.
Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God.
Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God.
Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Yesterday we talked about mercy and purity of heart. Are there any thoughts or things that just burned in your spirit the rest of the day that we need to put on the table this morning before we look at being peacemakers and persecuted? Okay. There are already poems up there on the balcony. Look at me learning by day five. This is a little longer than what we've looked at before. And thank you, by the way. Many of you have asked about, you know, mentioned the poems. Some of you have liked them. A couple of you have had a couple of you just wish you'd never seen. That's great. They weren't meant to be an answer. They were meant to be the start for a conversation. The Seven of Pentacles is the one we're starting with. Blessed are the peacemakers is where we are at today. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Listen in this poem and see if you can identify anything that strikes you as being a peacemaker. Under a sky the color of pea soup, she is looking at her work growing away there, actively, thickly, like grapevines or whole beans, as things grow in the real world, slowly enough. If you tend them properly, if you mulch, if you water, if you provide birds that eat insects a home and winter food, if the sun shines and you pick off the caterpillars, if the praying mantis comes and the ladybugs and the bees, then the plants flourish, but at their own internal clock. Connections are made slowly, Sometimes they grow underground. You cannot tell always by looking what is happening. More than half a tree is spread out in the soil under your feet. Penetrate quietly as the earthworm that blows no trumpet. Fight persistently as the creeper that brings down the tree. Spread like the squash plant that overruns the garden. Gnaw in the dark and use the sun to make sugar. Weave real connections. Create real nodes. Build real houses. Live a life you can endure. Make love that is loving. Keep tangling and interweaving and taking more in, a thicket and bramble wilderness to the outside, but to us, interconnected with rabbit runs and burrows and lairs. Live as if you like yourself, and it may happen. Reach out. Keep reaching out. Keep bringing in. This is how we are going to live for a long time. Not always. For every gardener knows that after the digging, after the planting, after the long season of tending and growth, the harvest comes. What images or phrases jump out at you from this poem?
Well, my only problem is that I've never seen this guy eat pea soup.
Oh. I think I have, and it's been before some really nasty storms.
Yeah. In the Midwest.
Yeah, you're out here, right?
Yeah.
Come to the Midwest. We'll show you a pea soup sky. We'll tell you to get in the cellar very quickly.
The part where it says connections are made slowly, that whole section resonates with me because I had a boss who was having a difficult time in her marriage, and I had never really told anyone that I worked with or made it obvious that I was a Christian. I don't know that I was afraid or ashamed, but I just kept it real quiet. But I told her that, there's somebody out there that loves you. And I told her about Jesus. And she just said, oh, I don't believe. And I know everybody thinks that you need to have religion now, but I just don't go along with that. Well, as the time progressed, there was probably maybe 6 months had passed. Her daughter came to work with us. And her daughter was, I think she was like 22 or 23. She was just married and starting a family. And she had lots of questions. And so we started conversations in the office. It was a big wide open area, and we'd holler across, well, what about, and why was Eve so terrible, and blah, 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 blah. Well, my boss now was a Christian. And I think it was because the seed got planted, and it took a while to grow, and nurture, and like it says, it grows underground, and that's kind of that, plant a seed, put the idea in their head, let them think about it, encourage, be there, be open. So that really resonated with me.
She's really good at that.
Good at what?
At doing what you just described.
Oh.
Oh. Other images that jump out?
Well, it's not even so much as words, but the artist, the poet, has done this amazing, for me at least, this feeling of intertwining and weaving and knitting, which for me so much is what shalom is all about. The whole thing is woven together, and you almost feel at the end like you've come around to the beginning. It's just tight.
Any other initial reactions? Yeah.
The one line I liked is, penetrate quietly as the earthworm that blows no trumpet. That's the line in the poem that calls to me.
I like, live a life you can endure. Because so often in my life, I seem to have encountered periods that I couldn't endure.
I will
connections. I tried to be crafty and weave something this week. And I had to keep asking for help. It kind of seems like a new relationship. I had to keep asking for help. And we talked to each other as we're working, and I looked at mine, and it was coming along, and this little 12-year-old next to me is twice as far with a much more complicated pattern. But I looked, and I thought, well, I can learn from her, too. And encouraging each other, and it kind of reminds me of how some of the relationships you go into that, mm-hmm. that take time and patience and encouragement and risking the failure. But now I have finished this weaving, and it's like, wow, I did it. But it's just like a friendship that's a surprise.
Yeah. I appreciated live as if you liked yourself, and it may happen. Mm-hmm. Just as I've gotten older, understanding that I'm not the only one that berates myself or or criticizes myself, but others do that too. And just coming to, seeking that place where you can like yourself enough to really reach out instead of being internalized too.
Any last one?
I like the rhythm expressed in reaching out and bringing in, as we know with trees, where plants take draw from their roots, and then they shift, they reach out, and then they open up and they recede. And I think that sense of peace, when you're no longer reaching, but you're just open and receptive to be filled.
Some of the words you threw out were words like messiness, risk, reaching out, filling. All of these words are interwoven with Blessed Are the Peacemakers. They're interwoven with all of these Beatitudes, because I think what the Beatitudes are essentially, I thank you for using the word weaving and the image, they are essentially a weaving. They come from these strong Jewish roots that Jesus had, and then he weaves them not only into his message and into his life, and gives them this entire new color and warmth and image that he puts out there and invites us to weave into our lives. Invites us to weave into one another's lives as we build the kingdom. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Peace is a word that we are fairly familiar with, right? It's in the Old Testament and New Testament over 400 times. It is in every book of the New Testament and shows up more than 88 times. It is a common word. If most of you are a group of Lutherans, if I say the peace of the Lord be with you, you would say,
also with you.
It's woven into our liturgy, it's woven into our consciousness. We recognize some of the openings of the letters of Paul because he greets people with peace. Peace is something that people knew and aspired to. That group on the hillside, however, aspired to a different vision of peace than we often do. When we say, I wish we were at peace, what are we often talking about?
War.
What?
Once more? War.
Free of conflict.
I wish we didn't have conflict. The traditional understanding of shalom was much more holistic, much more full. It wasn't just a matter of being free of conflict. It was a matter of being complete and filled and whole and in harmony and in right relationship. And things were woven well and they were woven tightly. Shalom encompassed justice. It encompassed all things being right with the world. We can have a lack of war and not have things right with the world, can we? Mm-hmm. That's not the peace that Jesus is talking about here. He refers to the word for peace here is a more Greek word, but it also elicits the images of shalom. Okay, it's kind of a weaving together, again, of two different cultures and images of peace. Shalom, the whole idea of completeness, and you drew a circle there. That complete is one of the definitions of shalom. Nothing is falling out, nothing is crumbling down here, it's complete. Everything is in harmony together, and nothing is falling apart. And shalom was a traditional, and still is, a traditional Jewish greeting. One of my neighborhood rabbis greets me regularly with the word shalom. Shalom. And it has been carried over into our tradition. You just responded to a greeting of peace that is common in our Christian tradition. Shalom is what people have pictured and imagined as Jesus on the other side said the word peace. But he said more than the word peace, didn't he? He said peacemaker. What's the difference?
Take somebody to attempt to reach out for the peace.
Be a catalyst.
Catalyst, someone who reaches out.
Intentional.
Intentionality.
Proactive.
Proactive. This is not, it does not say, blessed are those who like peace. Blessed are those who are at peace. But blessed are the peacemakers. It is an active word. It encompasses being filled. You have to, in some ways, have some peace within yourself in order to be a peacemaker. But it never stops, like we talked about in mercy and pure in heart. It doesn't stop here. It has to flow out. Peacemaker is an active word, someone who does what needs to be done. Took me some finding in the library because I wasn't sure where to find it, but one of the images that always comes to me on this is Desmond Tutu. How many of you have read or seen this book, No Future Without Forgiveness? It is essentially, I mean, it lays out how South Africa approached reconciliation. And what they had in South Africa were two models to approach what had happened over all those years of oppression and apartheid and segregation. All the people who had disappeared in custody, all of the acts of violence. They had two global models to look at for how to do this. One was the Nuremberg trials, right? Haul everyone into a court, name them innocent or guilty, punish them in a jail. The other, he refers to as national amnesia. Pretend it never happened. And one of the judges in charge of putting this together wrote, for a successfully negotiated transition, the terms of the transition required not only the agreement of those victimized by the abuse, but also those threatened by the transition. If the Constitution kept alive the prospect of continuous retaliation and revenge, the agreement of those threatened by its implementation might never have been forthcoming. If the Constitution had kept alive the prospect of continuous retaliation and revenge. And Tutu says, either one of those options, the trials or the national amnesia, would have kept that alive. When you aren't honest about something, there's going to be a moment where you are not looking for peace, you're looking for revenge. And sometimes when we put all of our emotions and all of our honesty in a court, we never really get to the truth. So he argues that they needed to find a third way. Third way, a compromise between those extremes. The third way was granting amnesty to individuals in exchange for a full disclosure relating to the crime for which amnesty was being sought. They called it the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And what they did was they invited people to come forward and admit what they had done wrong. Give a public confession. Records didn't exist for many of these actions. Some people never knew who took their family in the night. But if that person was willing to come forward and confess, and lay it all out there and be honest and put it on the table, they were granted amnesty from their crimes. A crossroads between honesty and amnesia. A place where they could put it on the table and find healing. Do any of you remember when this was actively taking place? It's an amazing thing. And it is something that can only be a peacemaking action, because that cycle of revenge and retaliation is so strong within us. It pulls deeply. And yet here was an opportunity for an entire country and community to come together in what becomes essentially a public act of confession and forgiveness, and out of that, peacemaking. It's an amazing example. It is imperfect, of course, but it is an amazing example that we don't always have to take the known way of revenge or the other way of dishonesty and forgetting. We can sometimes find a third way, or a fourth way, or a fifth way. And that's what peacemakers do. They don't just rest with being at peace without war. They make peace. They make the effort. They extend themselves to others to make the effort. Are there peacemakers that you have known in your life? People who you know who might be an example to someone else?
Yes, in the 50s, there was a great movement called the Young People's International Work Camp Association, and the Peace Corps came out of that. But we built monasteries and places, especially in Eastern France, and that had been torn apart during the campaigns of 1944. And they were students from all over, from Germany, from France, from the United States, Algeria, Madagascar. It was led by people who realized that the next generation couldn't be infected with revenge. Even though Nuremberg had taken care of some things.
Mm-hmm. They had to break the
cycle. They had to break the cycle because the French were suffering from amnesia. Still do, and the Germans were trying to find a way to get amnesia. Instead, so it's a long way, but it came out of the displaced persons camps of the late 40s.
What are some of the qualities that you need to be able to do that, to be a peacemaker, to cross boundaries, to step into the darkness or the brokenness that's standing right there in front of you and walk in it for a while? What are some of the qualities that you need?
Listening.
Courage. I think one thing is that it helps is if there becomes a personal connection. Because a coincidence, happened to know the guy that was the head of the Nestle's boycott, which was sort of a war, it was nonviolent, but they're boycotting Nestle's because Nestle's was encouraging, I think it was third world, mostly African women, to use Nestle's formula rather than breastfeeding. They used tainted water so the babies died, so that was the whole thing. But it went on for quite a while, but and I knew that Doug Johnson was ahead of it, and I knew him before all this happened. But when it ended was when he happened to sit on a train with the CEO of Nestle's, maybe somebody knows the story better. That's where I remember it, was he had a personal connection. And some of our reductions in arms happened when Reagan and Gorbachev mm-hmm. sat down, got all the other people in the room and actually talk to each other. So I think when people see each other as people, that often bridges the gap. When you no longer see each other as them, Bob Sorensen was talking last week about I and thou, and the other person becomes a thou, and it's a lot harder to think.
I think you need to have compassion to be a peacemaker.
Tell me what you mean by compassion.
Just being able to reach out to other people.
Persistence. Empathy.
Surrender.
Creativity.
Stand in their shoes.
Humility.
Pardon?
Humility. You put yourself with that other person ahead of yourself.
If you look back at the Beatitudes, do any of these look familiar? All of those previous things that we've talked about, meek slash debonair, because I like that word, that's kind of stuck with us. Meek, ability to mourn, meaning a willingness to completely throw yourself into the world. Throw yourself into loving the world, which requires courage. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit, those who have, one of you said, surrendered, emptied themselves. People who are willing to make connection, to have compassion and empathy, blessed are the merciful. All of those previous Beatitudes that we've talked about connect and weave into this one. To be able to be a peacemaker in a world that is not inclined toward peace, you need those other traits, those other pieces of being part of the kingdom of God. Yeah.
There was a show about 6 months ago on public television on Masterpiece Theater, so it's kind of a fictionalized but yet not fiction. And I, for the life of me, I'm beating myself up because I can't remember it. Mm-hmm. But it was about the talks that took place that were put together quietly before apartheid fell and ended. And it was pulling together of some of the primary people behind the scenes from the African side, from the native side, and then the Afrikaner and English side. But it was so amazing because it was, you know, at any moment it could have fallen apart. And yet they stuck with each other, and it really showed how hard it was. I mean, we think of peacemaking and it's kind of, you know. But I mean, these people wrestled with each other across the table and fought with each other across the table. And it was so amazing at the end because the final scene was just simply them hugging and getting into the car. I mean, and that was, I can't remember the name of it, though. William Hurt was one of the primary actors.
The other thing about being a peacemaker is that it requires risk. It requires risk for those people to sit down in a room together. It requires risk when you go to someone that you have a terrible conflict with and attempt to reconcile. It requires risk to bring about peace. And it's not, if you are a peacemaker, if we take that as an active word, as an active invitation, then it's not something where you can stand back and say, I'm just going to wait for them to come to me. Because sometimes that will never happen. If you are the peacemaker, you have to take the risk. You have to make the effort. You have to take the step. Now, that doesn't always mean your step will be received. Either of those folks could have come across away from the table. But it does mean that you have been a peacemaker. You've made the effort. You've stepped out and you've taken your faith and you've taken all of these things that Christ has called us to, and you've taken the risk to reach out in love. It doesn't always end well. We know this. But we're not called to worry about the ending.
You have to have a certain amount of commitment to that end as well, to the results.
And to trust who does have the end. It's not you or me.
That's what I said.
Yeah. The end is in God's hands. It's not ours.
We're faced with a real challenge in our church where we see congregations splitting or half going one way, half going another, or leaving. And so, what is it that we're not getting about handling conflict? And I served a church that was half Lutheran and half Roman Catholic. and there was a priest on the staff, and I, and we started worship together every Sunday. But we did it under the theme, we celebrate our oneness in Christ at the same time that we honor our differences. So real peacemaking starts with a sense of a level of unity, of oneness.
Going back to knowing common humanity, I think that was a phrase you used the other day. Knowing our common humanity, that there is a unity, and that there are ways in which our lives are, to go back to that poem, a thick bracket bramble wilderness that is interconnected. We cannot imagine the ways that we are interconnected. We had a family at St. John's. I was telling Laura about them the other day. They were an Iranian family that had at some point been able to walk out of the country. They had walked, eventually end up in Germany. They were refugees. At some point while they were in Germany, they converted to Christianity. And they showed up at St. John's, I think because the World Relief people knew that even though we had told them that we really needed a break from the refugee work, that if those people showed up on our doorstep, we'd take them anyway. So go to worship at St. John's on Sunday, they said. And it worked. People took them in. But what was fascinating was watching how they tried to understand peace, how they tried to grapple with it, and how they tried to explain to me the importance of interconnectedness in figuring out how to be peaceable. There are not a lot of Iranians in the Quad Cities. And those that were there knew members of their family in the town they were from in Iran. And it was not a wise thing to convert to Christianity. So there was this continual effort in the community between these folks who were also from Iran and still Muslim, and these folks who had come and converted, to continually try to be at peace. And Miriam, the mother, said to me at one point, everybody's telling me I should just shut up and back down and we don't even talk about it and pretend it's not there. But it is there. We've got to talk about it. So I keep bringing it up, and they keep not wanting to talk about it, but I keep trying to build a bridge. Eventually the bridge took them to a place where there was a larger Iranian community because it just couldn't, they couldn't get there. But she made the effort to be a peacemaker, and she took a risk every time she did that. Every time she opened herself and said, there is this estrangement between us that we need to bridge. And she walked right into it and said, let's figure it out. Reconciliation. Blessed are those who bring healing and reconciliation into God's creation, into God's world. Blessed are those who are peacemakers.
Stacey, I think something you said a minute ago, you said the word love a minute ago, mm-hmm. and I keep thinking about Jeff's sermon last night.
Yes.
There has to be, in order for peacemaking to work, there has to be it has to be driven by love, and done with a sense of joy or hope. Because so often, peacemaking is done out of hatred and revenge. I mean, it's things have to be my way, and my way is peace, and it just never works.
I'm the winner, and you want to be the winner on the other side, winner wannabe. And we're trying to make peace. That's going to fall apart, right? Because there is no greater motivation behind either of you than simply achieving a moment of absence of conflict until you can have the moment where you can now one up the next guy.
It very much sounds like my five-year-old.
Yeah.
And there's no getting past it. You know, if that's his mindset, you might as well move on to something else. It's not going to work.
To be a peacemaker, you need to be committed to the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, if you commit yourself to the end, or even the technique of how to get to the end.
Or even if you commit to how you think it should end.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So just stay committed, you have to be committed to the opportunity of maybe something will work out even knowing what that might be.
And maybe to come back full circle, what is the opportunity? Tom mentioned it.
The conversation.
The opportunity is relationship. One of the other definitions out there for peacemaker is someone who maintains right relationships with God, one another, and the world. You can't enter into the opportunity unless you enter into relationship. You can't enter into relationship until real relationship, until you enter into it with love. And to do that, you have to have so many of those other traits that we've talked about this week. Other thoughts? Is this going to go easily or well?
No.
Always. No.
It's hard. It occurs to me that in our daily lives, we do this at some level with people.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a preschool teacher, there were several times that I had to approach a parent with a concern about the need for more assistance for the child, that maybe they were on had some level of autism. And parents don't want to hear it. And they often will come back with anger. But then in both cases that I had to do that, I heard later on in their child's life that they did end up having the experience where a teacher or an educator would come to them and talk to them about it, and they found the right channel to help them deal with the situation. But what I learned through that is that sometimes when you're the first line, you don't see a result, but that there's progress.
What he said about not committing to the outcome.
Right.
You open a door.
Right.
It's not about you.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
We talk about love a lot, but I think even the first step is to respect. Because we want to go to love, and then it gets really hard. But I even think about some of the peacekeeping things that we do, or the justice issues that we do, and kind of connecting into what the person who's sitting ahead of me, we demonize the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And the second we do that, it's almost like we're messed from the beginning, because, mm-hmm. you know, but then we're doing exactly the same thing. We're not willing to listen, we're not willing to say, okay, I can try to understand your position. You're a human being too. You know, we paint them evil rather than stepping back and saying, how can we get this woven back together?
We jump past walking in their shoes and knowing who they are to knowing who we want them to be.
We definitely prefer things to be black and white whenever possible.
I would. Yeah. So,
sorry.
And then we'll...
In what I've done for some number of years in the legal field, we do a lot of settlement negotiations and mediations. And we have the saying that a good settlement is one that everyone hates.
Mm-hmm.
And that the best way to sell the resolution of conflict is to balance the cost of resolution against the cost of further conflict. There used to be a bumper sticker saying that war doesn't determine who's right, but only who's left. And I think that there is a tendency to underestimate the cost of conflict. I think of our own country's initial assessment of the cost of our decision to become involved in Iraq. And regardless of how one felt about the choice, I think that everyone would agree that the initial assessments of the cost were wildly optimistic. And my years in the legal field, and specifically in litigation, I learned that rare indeed was the case where either side in a legal dispute correctly assessed the cost pressing through without a settlement, invariably rosy visions of an easy victory filled minds on both sides. And only when people started sitting down looking at their stacks of legal bills and the uncertainties of courts and juries could they begin to consider the possibility that a settlement in which they got some but not all that they wanted would be in the long run more cost effective than continuing the conflict. And sometimes people would say to me, well, what if you want to get those people? You know, we want to defeat those people. And I would say to them, if you do prevail, don't dance on the grave. By which I meant, don't rub in your victory. Don't go for the last little ounce of punitive result. Leave them some room to breathe.
Well, leave some room for reconciliation. You're talking about two pieces here. Sometimes there are, we talked yesterday about how there are mixed motives for everything, right? We don't get the 100% pure. But sometimes you take those mixed motives and you turn them into a conversation. It's maybe because you want at some point to be able to walk together in love or respect, but at some point you've just got to sit down and measure the costs, depending on the scale, right? And that is a settlement. That is weighing, you know, what will I win, what will I lose? And that's a little different than reconciliation, which can only happen if you don't dance on the grave.
It's very
that requires love, that requires respect, requires the empathy and the persistence and the courage, the courage to go past figuring out a win-win and more figuring out a mutual journey.
Because a settlement gets you in the legal field no more than armed neutrality.
Armed neutrality.
I mean, the parties don't really reconcile. They haven't really...
I kind of miss the days of armed neutrality.
Buried the hatchet. You know, they still don't like each other. But they've reached a point where they're no longer actively firing paper at each other. But to try to get them to the point of true reconciliation, that I fear certainly was beyond my skill.
It's beyond, I think, most of our skills, but that's what we're talking about. We're talking about peace as something more than settlement, something more than the Pax Romana, having enough soldiers that nobody's ever going to pick on you, something more than armed neutrality or waiting for the next five-year-old figuring out step. We're talking about reconciliation, relationship, humility, all of these things. We're not talking about peace as just, when do I get my shot? We're talking about peace as we are on the journey together. And how do we find a way that each other can live with the most vital life and love possible? And that's the vision that Jesus gives us on that hillside, on that mountainside. Find a way in the world to help others and yourself live with the most powerful vision of life and love possible. It may require that you be meek, or that sometimes you mourn, or, as the next one says, that sometimes you will be persecuted, right? After all of these things about how to live and how to build bridges and how to be complete and how to find reconciliation, all of this powerful imagery of how to be with God in the world and how to reflect God in the world. Then there's this zinger at the end. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. We started out being offered the kingdom of heaven. We're ending being offered the kingdom of heaven. And then snuck there in the middle is the word persecuted. You will be persecuted for righteousness' sake. Just a non-interactive show of hands. How many of you have ever felt at some point on some day in some moment that you have been persecuted for being right with God in your choices? I didn't say being right, right with God in your choices. So you have a sense of what that means. When we talked about immigration last night, and I remembered a gentleman from Rockford that I had been doing work with, building a hospital in Africa. He owned a business. I was coordinating supplies being sent to the hospital, and he was helping to pay for that. And we became, I thought, friends. He was at Synod Assembly, and at that time, it's been a few years now, but there was a previous immigration effort that was trying to remove the kind of neutrality of clergy. There was a bill in Congress that basically said churches could not offer any aid and comfort to anyone who was illegal and offered consequences for that. And aid and comfort by those who were trying to put forward this law was being defined as anything from housing to communion. And so someone had brought forward a resolution to the Synod Assembly and said, we're going to support anyone in the Synod who's willing to break this law. And I got up and said, if this law passes, I will break this law. And these are the ways in which I will break the law. I will give milk to the kids in the neighborhood. If one of them comes to communion, I will give them communion. If one of them asks to be baptized, I will be baptized. I will give aid and comfort. I will break this law. And I would expect the church to support me. And my friend in Rockford has not spoken to me since. You all have stories like that, where you felt you made the right choice. Even if it wasn't a choice that in the end you had to make or do, but you put it out there and said, to be right with God, to be meek and humble and poor in spirit, to fully give myself to the love of the world, to find reconciliation, this is where I have to stand. And Jesus says, you will be persecuted for that.
Yeah. The other phrase that comes to my mind and has relatively recently in my life is, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I would like to add patience to that list. Sometimes it requires patience and silence. When you get that, you know, when you are on that receiving end of the persecution, then it's time to surrender and let God take care of it.
Now, several of you asked about joy on the first day and the second day and the third day and the fourth day. Where is the joy in this?
Joy in being persecuted.
Say more.
If you're being persecuted, from what I understand, if you're not pissing people off, you're not doing something right.
Yeah.
So if you're finding yourself persecuted, apparently you're saying something that is striking home with whoever is persecuting you. So you must be doing something right to find joy in that, rather than looking at it as a negative experience, go, get my tail handed to me, I must be doing something right. Be happy in that.
Where is the joy?
I don't think there's always joy. Sometimes there isn't.
Well, I don't think there's always happiness, but maybe there
can be satisfaction or conviction.
Yeah.
And, you know, another part of this is, what if you're wrong? You stick to this course, and I've been thinking about Neville Chamberlain this week. A person who went out and tried to make peace, and it blew up in his face, and he was disgraced. I think we should have a memorial to him or something.
But
poor guy.
To make peace.
Yeah, he tried to make peace, and he was dealing with a power bigger than he realized, and he was wrong. And sometimes that happens, and you have to. It takes a lot of faith to keep going. Joy's not going. I don't know what you call that emotion. Well, at least I try.
Jason?
Well, I'm just thinking that this joy doesn't seem, it depends on the results, right? I mean, the peace markers are blessed, are given joy. And Jesus gets crucified, right? I mean, a radically unsuccessful peacemaker, if you want to look at it like that, right?
Jesus lives all of these qualities and ends up on a cross.
Yeah, that it's not that here's a tactic that will bring about maximum comfort in some ways. It's a kind of calling to a way that's blessed as a way and not blessed because it'll work.
Well, this is not promoted on any of the television evangelist shows.
Well, and you think about this for a moment. How many times have you heard a television evangelist or some other person, hopefully of good faith, who is trying to speak about their faith, talk about how if you are a Christian, you will be happy and safe and at peace, and you will have more than enough. There's that prosperity gospel that's just rampant out there, that all will be well and easy if you are a Christian.
Can you imagine Joel Osteen saying, and all these things, and you'll be crucified. This is the goal, you know?
Yeah, it's not the case. We hear those people, and they're building this beautiful image of delusion, to use a word that we heard yesterday a couple times. They're building this image that is not true, and you know how we know it's not true? Because Jesus says that. Jesus says you will be persecuted. Guess what? You're still going to mourn. Guess what? You're still going to need to take a back seat sometimes to other people. Guess what? You're still going to have to risk and have courage and be persistent and surrender. None of that fits with that easy, easy prosperity image. It's a different kind of blessing.
That prosperity image is, again, being committed to the outcome.
Being committed to the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Being committed to the opportunity.
We've got 1, 2, 3.
There's a certain sense, I mean, as it's been said, but it just needs to be said so many times, joy and happiness are not the same thing.
They are not the same thing.
And there's just a certain deep, it's almost like this deep-seated hum for me of feeling like I'm doing everything I can to be in harmony with God. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I might be right in the middle of some really situations, but there's just, you know, a certain inner rhythm that feels right, and not being right, but just like I'm dancing with God, and dancing with people around me.
What did someone say earlier was trusting that the end is not ours. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That in all of this, your help. It comes back to that basic state of being held by God. And that is a whole different joy than the happiness of winning the fight. Go ahead.
I just wanted to know how in my congregation, in my neighborhood, in my town, I mean, if I want to step out of the box and be a peacemaker, where do you go? How do you start? I mean, I can't be a Mandela. I can't be a forefront figure in the world wars, or I don't have any interaction with the Irans or the Muslims or whatever, even in our community, and I'm from a pretty big city, but how do you get involved? How do you become?
Do you have any tables at your church?
We do.
Are they round?
No.
No? No, that's okay. You've got tables, though, right? You have chairs?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a coffee pot?
Mm-hmm.
A stove?
Yeah.
Start by bringing people around the table and eating. Mm-hmm. With no agenda. With no, I want to know how to fix you or me or this. But more, I want to know you or me.
Just build the relationship.
Build the relationships.
Mm-hmm.
That's
where
you're
passionate about. And you don't try to live out someone else's passion, because then it won't work. But you find something that you're passionate about that strikes a fire in you, and then it might not be anything huge. It might be fair trade coffee in your church, or but you find something you're passionate about.
We change it piece by piece. Mm-hmm. Bring your heart, bring your passion, and don't bring any other agenda. Other than living that passion and that hunger and thirst for righteousness. Yeah.
You asked about joy, and for me, the joy comes from my relationship with Christ. From that relationship gives me joy. where it all comes from. And that's where the motivation to do any of this comes from. It feels like the flip side is the joy is the source, not the end result, but the source of it all.
The joy of the Lord is my strength.
Rejoice and be glad is actually how Jesus ends these Beatitudes. It's all going to come at you, but rejoice and be glad. It's happened to those before you. It'll happen to those after you. Rejoice and be glad. Because you are held in God's heart. And you know that. Yeah.
I'd like to follow up on that because Jesus says, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives. So there's one thing that is conflict resolution. But the other thing is not to try too hard to be at peace in ourselves. As I started out as a pastor and went to visit in the hospital, I kept thinking, wow, I've got to have the right things to say. I've got to do things right. I've got to make these people really feel at rest and at peace. And I was trying too hard. And I discovered that what I needed to do is get centered myself. God is present. God will guide me. My trust in that peace is what gave me a power to move in and bring peace. Not that I could make peace happen.
No. Right, the thing about being in right relationship with God leads you to being in right relationship with the world and with one another. One more.
Thinking about Neville Chamberlain, who is sometimes dismissed as a failure, I think it's instructive to go back and read the speech given by Winston Churchill, who was his arch foe for much of their mutual careers in the House of Commons when Chamberlain died in the early years of the Second World War. Far from pointing out the mistakes that Chamberlain had made, misunderstanding or misapprehending the threat of Hitler, Churchill gave a beautiful flowing speech about Chamberlain as the peacemaker and about how Chamberlain had failed. He had failed in the cause of peace and therefore honorably. And I think of all the things I've ever read about peacemaking, that would be on my short list of things to go back to. Because in essence, Churchill says that the result doesn't really matter in the end as much as the fact that Chamberlain had an honest heart, really wanted peace, and really put everything on the line for it.
And I think that's as good a place to maybe stand for a bit as any. We are not, in the course of any of these Beatitudes, promised success. We are not promised a particular worldly outcome. Remember in the temptations, those of you who were here on Monday, we talked about how one of the things that was offered to Jesus was the kingdoms of the world. And those had very clear outcomes, success, power, fame, all of that. We are not promised the kingdoms of this world. We're not promised those things. We are promised the kingdom of heaven. And living into that, there may be persecution. There may be pain. There will be all of these. But it's part of the journey. And as one of you said, we are held by God in that journey. As long as we strive for those right relationships with God, we are held by God in that humility. As we strive for love and relationships with one another, we are held by God in that. Trusting the journey and not the outcome. Doesn't mean I don't want to succeed, but trusting the journey and not the outcome. So to come back with what you asked, where do I start? As Laura said, pick your place and start. You can't leave here whenever you leave and say, I am now going to be all of these things. But start prayerfully living into some piece of them. Start prayerfully working on your courage. Because I think, we haven't talked about it much, fear is woven through all of these. Start working on your courage, or your compassion, or your connection with someone that you haven't connected with. And start keeping your eyes to where God is. We are 1 minute past, or a couple minutes past. There is a second poem on the back of your page. How many of you know this poem? Really?
Yes, I love Muriel.
Oh, fantastic. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your wild and precious life? Go in peace, serve the living God.
Thanks.